Good morning. The Joint Committee on Tax Reform will come to order for our meeting on May 11th, 2017. Colleagues, we're continuing our information meeting this morning on a business tax reform discussion, and we have the great privilege of having in attendance today the Oregon State Treasurer, who I think wants to address us on this topic. Would you come forward, Mr. Treasurer, and give us your wisdom?
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed. I have the honor of serving as Oregon State Treasurer, and I'm honored to be back in this room. As a former member of the House Revenue Committee, I enjoy being part of these discussions. And before I say anything else, I really want to commend your efforts and your willingness to take on this question. It's hard for me to think of anything that would have a bigger impact on making good decisions and on the future of the state than revenue stability. And that's the perspective from which I want to offer just a couple of quick observations. One of my jobs as state treasurer is to look after the state's credit rating, and we interact frequently with the three major rating agencies, Moody's, Fitch, and Standard & Poor's. They look at a number of different factors to determine our state credit rating. And obviously good credit ratings mean a number of good things for the state. Not only do we get better rates when we are issuing bonds, giving us the ability to finance more critical infrastructure and long-term projects, but we save taxpayers millions by our ability to refinance some of that debt. And we've done that over the last several years to the tune of several hundred million dollars, thanks to the good work of the folks in the Debt Management Division. Earlier this year, we met with all of those rating agencies and presented our information, our numbers, the story of Oregon. And just a few weeks after that, I'm proud to tell you, happy to tell you, that all three rating agencies confirmed the strong rating that we enjoy. But this year, just like every other year, they pointed to Oregon's income instability as a serious issue for them. I think all of us who've been part of this process understand that roller coaster we ride from biennium to biennium means less certainty about the money that the state is bringing in, and that means less certainty in our ability to repay. That is at the heart of the issue that the rating agencies have identified. A direct cause of that, of course, is our over-reliance on the income tax. So there are a couple of quotes that are worthwhile. Fitch said it pretty clearly, quoting directly, "Fitch expects Oregon's revenues with a heavy dependence on the personal income tax to continue to reflect the strength of the economy as well as its volatility." These rating agencies also recognize the kicker and the problem that the kicker poses for our ability to plan and save for the future. Moody's had identified it by saying, quote, "The rating also incorporates Oregon's high exposure to personal income tax volatility and the constitutional 2% kicker on personal income taxes that prevents the state from fully capturing the revenue boost during periods of economic strength." I want to acknowledge and compliment your focus on revenue stability and end where I began, because I think all of us should be able to agree that can contribute to our capacity to make good decisions and good use of taxpayer dollars. We stand ready to be helpful as we can and really compliment your work. So I appreciate the chance to be in front of you and wish you good luck in the discussions to come. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do you have time for a few questions?
Sure.
Thank you. Questions for our treasurer? You must have covered it all. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. All right. Thank you all. Good luck.
All right. And the second piece of our discussion this morning comes from our own Dr. Warner.
I'm going to head down. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. We have been working, Chris and I, and also our consultant, Ed Waters, we've been working frantically on simulations for various proposals. We don't have as much material for you as we had hoped. We were working on some simulations revolving around the proposal the speaker spoke to you about. We've got a couple of glitches we run into and wanted to hold off until next week to so we could present that fully and understand what we're presenting. So we plan to do that next week. We do have a simulation that would give you a sense of kind of what some of the policies implications are. Senator Haas has worked around a framework proposal that's within the framework of the work group and puts in some specific numbers and some specific personal income tax changes. So this is the outline of that proposal that we've run the simulation on. It is the Ohio base. As you recall, the FIT and the PAT are a couple of Ohio terms. The FIT is the financial institutions tax, which is separate from the general commercial activity tax in Ohio, but it's really designed around gross receipts and has specific means of estimating gross receipts for financial institutions. So we would envision something like that being part of the overall commercial or corporate activity tax in Oregon. The PAT is the petroleum activity tax, and this has to do with the same issue around the highway fund in Ohio that we have, and basically we've estimated what you would generate from a, in this case, from the applying the rate at the wholesale level to the sale of motor fuels. We built that into those total revenue impact numbers, but a portion of that would go into the highway fund. So it's roughly about $50 million a biennium. So the rest of it is around some of the threshold issues that you've talked about. They maintain the filing threshold of $150 in sales, a flat $150 for business with sales less than $1 million, and a 0.48 rate on sales above $1 million. So the personal income tax rate structure would be adjusted. Now, of course, we have a 5, 7, 9, and 9.9 rate structure. What we're assuming here is to go to a new structure with 4.5, 6.5, 8.5, retain the 9.9, and all of those brackets would stay the same. So there'd be no change in the current brackets that we have. And then there would be an elimination of the corporate income tax, and we're assuming a 2018 start year. So what we've done, I'm going to go ahead and go to the sim, is run through a simulation on what those results would look like. And just let me tell you a couple things reminiscent about the simulations and what we how to interpret them. We are taking the Oregon economy at a point in time, and then we are shocking the system, as they would say in modeling language, shocking the system with this new revenue package, and then its system comes to a new equilibrium. So we're comparing that new equilibrium with where we are now. It's what we call comparative statics. So we're comparing two points in time, a point now compared to where we would be after the economy adjusts to this change in the tax system in terms of the markets, in terms of labor markets, product markets, in terms of in-migration, out-migration, all of those factors that would come in and influence the economy. Of course, the big ones are the labor market, how it affects wages and employment, and consumer prices, and how that would affect the distribution of the tax burden and how the tax may affect the price level. So these first block here in the output, and some of you are familiar, and I know some of you aren't, so I encourage you to ask questions if there's something that isn't clear. The first line there is nominal personal income, which is the total sum of resident personal income in the state. This is what the state economist forecasts is the kind of the basis for beginning point for the tax, the revenue forecast. You can see that our economy in terms of its overall size in 2018 is about $200 billion. So that gives you a rough idea. Whenever we say 1%, we're talking about $2 billion. If you look at the baseline, which is where the current law forecast is, And we've consolidated that transition period and pulled it all into 2018. And we're saying, okay, after the economy's fully adjust, where is it going to be compared to the current forecast? And the answer in terms of income is about the same place. It's 0.04%, so it's less than 0.5% different than what the forecast would be. So we're saying when all is said and done with this proposed change, the overall income level is pretty much what it was projected to be. The nominal per capita income is down slightly, and you can see from about 47,442 to 47,380. So again, pretty much a very similar overall result. We do in this simulation see an increase in employment, and you can see there in the third line, the baseline is about 2.6 million. And this is a little bit broader definition than you see from the state economists. It includes, it's the Census Bureau data, so it includes not only payroll workers that are in the Employment Department's payroll survey, but also proprietors, for example, so it's a broader definition. But you can see that overall the employment numbers after running this simulation are slightly higher, about 7,500 higher, 0.3% than in the current projection. So again, what we're doing is we're imposing this new tax system. It's generating additional revenue in the system that you saw, and employment numbers, the employment equilibrium is higher. Now, in terms of this model, this is not a cyclical model. So it's not based on the assumption that we've got a bunch of idle labor out there that can be drawn into the workforce. The employment comes from two sources. One is it comes from in-migration, people coming into the state, and we have migration equations. The migration equations are more sensitive at the higher end. They're more sensitive to the return to capital, return to labor, than they are at the lower end. But still, there's migration responds in the economy, and so you can see if you look at employment, there is a modest increase in population. So we are getting an increase in net migration. Again, this is compared to the current law forecast where we have migration built into the system. So we're saying we'll get slightly more in migration than we're forecasting. So that adds some to the labor force. The other piece that adds to the labor force, and this is a consistent finding we have around adjusting the marginal personal income tax rates. This is what we call more intense use of the labor force. We assume, as all economists do, that labor responds to higher wages, to higher net wages or take-home wages. So if you look on the two lines below there in the wage index, you can see that the wage index in this simulation is actually a little lower. So wages are lower in this simulation. Well, how can that be that wages are lower and people are willing to work more? Well, that's where the marginal rates come into play. With a lower marginal income tax rate, the take-home pay or after-tax wage is higher. So we assume that labor responds to that. More people are willing to work. We have more intense use of the existing labor force. So people come into the labor force. From an employer standpoint, the wage is actually lower because they're paying the nominal wage, not the take-home wage. So the result of that marginal income tax reduction is to give employees, give workers more incentive to be in the labor force and firms an incentive to hire them. And so this is a common result we've had. So it when you first look at it, it seems kind of counterintuitive that why would we have an income tax rate and the wage go down? And that's the reason. It's the nominal wage or gross wage that goes down. The net wage is still going up after tax. So, and that's where we've consistently had that finding in these results. The other things you can see is overall investment in the economy does increase in this simulation by 33 million or 0.2%. So there is an increase, and this is again something we've seen typically as we move away from an income-based tax to a destination-based to a consumption-based tax, we tend to get more investment. We can have this consistent finding in our simulation. So you end up with more employment, more investment, and of course the two are, we tend to think of them oftentimes as substitutes about automation and so forth, but They're also complements. I mean, as capital and labor tend to grow together as they're responding to increased demand. So the return to capital is higher, and the other thing is the impact of the CAT is on price levels. The price levels are up about 0.15%. So that's going to translate into higher consumer prices. Okay, so the price level is up by that amount. We'll look at that and see how that's affected the distribution of the tax burden. The next block around the static, if you look at the revenue impacts here, the static revenue impact, that's just for 1 year. You saw what the biennial estimates were. And then we have what we call a dynamic revenue impact. This is the secondary impact of changes in economic activity. And in general, you can see the nominal personal income is down slightly, and that's the reason why the dynamic impact is negative, but it's extremely small. Usually we'll get just a straight revenue proposal, a straight tax increase or a decrease, we tend to get a feedback effect of around 5 to 10%. So this is less than 1%, so very little dynamic effect. And so the economy is roughly neutral in response to this revenue raising proposal. So then the next block that we always look at, and there's always a lot of interest, is around the impact on the distribution of the tax burden. So first of all, we have in our OTIM model, we have 9 household groups, starting with the less than 20,000, and then we have a above 205,000 group as the highest group. Now, one thing to note is these groups are not of equal size. They may be equal in terms of their impact on the economy, but not in terms of the number of households. So that's something to keep in mind. And we did it this way rather than do quintiles, for example, I think it was easier for people to understand and think about, you know, who's in those, what does that mean to be in those kind of income brackets. So what you're doing in any of these proposals that raise revenue is you are transferring resources from the private sector to the public sector. And so what this block does is it shows kind of the distribution of that additional tax burden, how it's distributed among those income groups. So that's why you're always going to get a negative number here, because it's transferring resources to the public sector. But again, the differences in percentages are small. And a typical finding we've had, and we've looked at dozens of traditional kind of retail sales tax proposals over the years, and they tend to be pretty much distributed in a regressive manner, much more so than the something like a commercial activity tax. Commercial activity tax, just looking at it on its own without the income tax changes, tends to be pretty close to spread evenly across the groups. You have the consumer price effect at the low end, but you also have some effects on pass-through income at the higher end, because we're assuming that net income is going to be reduced by the CAT for people that are passing through the income. So it has more of a balanced effect than just a straight retail sales tax. And then, of course, the other factor that comes into play is the income rate reductions here. And you can see that the beneficiaries primarily of that rate reduction are in that middle income, lower middle to middle income group. There's no net effect on the 48 to 68 group, a positive 0.1 on the 34 to 48 group. The less than 20,000 group does have a slight negative effect. And the reason for that is the rates have a minimal effect on them. They don't usually pay much in terms of income taxes. So the bigger effects from the income rate reduction are in that, you know, folks that are in working families where they're getting a wage, and they're also paying in some of their higher percentage of their income on that 5% and 7% bracket. So they're the ones benefiting from that 0.5% reduction more proportionally. And then as you move up the scales, you get up to above 205,000. Of course, a rate reduction, when that's imposed, no matter how high your income, you're still getting some reduction in your taxes, because you pay a portion of your taxes in the 5% and 7% brackets five, seven, and nine brackets. It's just that proportion of your income is smaller than it is for the person in the middle income. So that means that that spread all the way across the those income groups, those brackets, affect everybody, essentially. So that gives you an idea of the kind of analysis we get from the simulations. You know, we can look at different proposals and how they would affect them. For example, if you wanted to have more effect on the lower than 20,000, you know, the earned income tax credit. We've talked about a circuit breaker for property tax relief at the low end. Those kinds of things can be plugged into these policy packages and directed at particular income groups. That's kind of where we are. We have found that, again, I think the one of the basic conclusions we've had from these models is that substituting a consumption or destination-based tax for an income-based or a property-based tax, even if they're of equal yield, or even in cases like this where you're generating revenue, the impact on the economy, the negative impact from the destination-based tax is generally less than the positive impact from lowering property or income taxes. And that's because of the economy is more sensitive to those things. The way an economy grows is either you get a flow of labor and capital into the state. If your tax policy changes that return on labor, return to labor through take-home wages or to capital, you're going to get more labor and capital in your state, and you're going to grow. Consumption or destination-based taxes tend to have less of an effect on overall economic activity. They don't have the effect on the relative competitive position of our exporters, which we've talked about a lot. So that's the result that we have, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Nose, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Paul, can you, for those of us that don't live and breathe this, tell us if any of these percentage changes are statistically significant? Which ones would you say that's a number that you should, that's important number to look at versus ones that really it's kind of de minimis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nose. Couple things. One is these are simulations, so we're not trying to, you know, they're not something we can go back and test to see, you know, against actual events like we can with the forecast, for example. So we're looking at something to modify the current forecast. And of course, you know that if we look out 5 years from now, whatever we're predicting now, there's probably going to be 1,000 things we didn't anticipate that can, 1,000 different variables that can affect things. So it's very hard to go back and, you know, and run some kind of a diagnostic comparison. So I think in terms of the way to look at these, it's, you know, it's reasonable to expect that a change, you know, of say in the 1% or 1.5% range is pretty small in terms of the overall economy. We're saying with the results here that that's the central tendency. For example, if we have a change of 0.29 in employment, we're saying, well, that's a central tendency that we would expect the mean to be slightly higher than what the current law forecast is. But certainly a no impact would be a reasonable outcome, too. It would be within the plausible range. So I would say anything, say, a full 1% swing either way would be something we would expect to be plausible, that it's that there is little impact or no impact.
Yeah, follow up.
So what if we substituted this tax with a sales tax? Would the numbers look different? Especially like down in the maybe in the disposable income, household income. You know, would those things change pretty significantly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nose, we can show you those comparisons. Yes, they do. We've looked at those. As I mentioned, what we see with something like a CAT is we still see that effect on consumer prices. So you're going to see that impact down at the lower household end where the consumption-to-income ratio was higher than the higher household income ranges. But you also see it spread more across up in the upper income ranges, and again, I think that's primarily through the impact on net pass-through income. So net pass-through income, if these, you know, with these entity taxes, they're paying the entity tax, and that can affect their net income. So, and they tend to be at the higher end group. So it's more evenly spread across the income spectrum than a retail sales tax. Retail sales tax tends to be more regressive, more at the lower end, okay, proportionally.
Thank you. Senator Hess, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. These things are always mysteries to me when they come out. But I do know that positive job creation or increase of 7,500 and investment is up. So that feels like an economic benefit. I guess my question to you is, okay, how, if following up on Representative Noss's point, I think, was what would you tweak here to keep that economic benefit but not change some of the other things that we want to move up, or would you, or is it perfect as it is? We got our first shot.
You should know by now, there's nothing perfect in tax policy. Yeah. There's always trade-offs. And but I do think, you know, I think one of the real important messages here is that you're raising revenue, and a fair amount of revenue in this proposal. And, of course, I mean, people have a different notion of what the appropriate amount is, but this is a significant increase in revenue. Yet the impacts on the economy are, as you point out, in positive in terms of investment and employment. So I think that's, you know, that's telling you that taxes are not always necessarily bad in terms of overall economic activity. And as we've talked about a number of times, we're really not incorporating the full effects of the spending side either here. We're building in the demand side. You know, we hire people, and we're not, you know, when the public sector gets more resources. So, and I think that's still, if you look at the justifications of the co-chairs, for example, co-chair and speaker when they were here last week, they're talking about what you're going to use that money for. And ultimately, in the long run, I think that's a real critical issue. So to have a revenue-raising proposal that has, you know, even some positive impacts on the economy is notable and an important thing. We've talked about this before, and when we've looked at you know, some of these destination-based tax increases mixed with some reductions in other taxes that stimulate more investment, you know, you can be in a situation where you can actually have additional resources and still some positive effects on the economy.
Senator Breschinger, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Warner, ever since Senator Hess and I had these discussions over a year ago, maybe it was longer than a year ago, trying to get my arms around how this would play out. I don't disagree with your positive thoughts on this and how it'll affect the economy if you're just looking at our tax plan. However, we keep forgetting that there's a federal tax plan, and it's starting to become more and more apparent to me that there's two pathways. The federal government is going down one pathway, and we're going down another pathway. And when you're not blending those two, looking at it from a business standpoint, who is always trying to reduce their tax liability, it gets very complicated. And I'll give you a quick example. The Congress finally made Section 179 permanent, which is a $500,000 accelerated depreciation on capital improvements. If we go down this pathway, we do not benefit from that tax policy of the federals in any size, shape, or form. And so those are very difficult decisions for a business, and it gets very complicated. So it may be simplistic from the point of view from the state, but I think it increases the how complex it is looking at it from a business standpoint. And I'm very concerned about that.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of follow-up things on Senator Breschinger's comments. In terms of how we treat the direct interaction with the federal, you can see one of the lines there under public sector is the bottom line there in the first block is federal tax paid by Oregonians. You can see that goes up because of by 61 million, that's because of the lower income tax rate. So there is a feedback there where you're going to owe more in federal taxes because you have less state taxes to deduct. Now that may go away in federal tax changes, so, but right now that's the current law. The other thing we did do, in which we've done with all of our corporate tax proposals, we assume we built in before we ran the simulation the deductibility of the CAT. So the CAT will be deductible on your federal return as a state and local tax. And of course, if you're a pass-through entity, you'll be able to deduct that at the entity level. So that means you're going to shift roughly 25% of that tax burden to the federal government, because you're going to be able to deduct that tax. But in terms of kind of the federal system and how that interacts, I think that is a very important issue. We do believe, certainly at the personal income tax level, that when you talk about responses to tax changes, that the federal changes are much bigger than the state ones, because the rates are so much higher and the impact is so much greater. So we think people respond a lot more to federal changes than they do to state changes.
Please, yeah.
Just to point out that when you do write off your state taxes on your federal taxes, it's the next year. Mm-hmm. So it's not the year that those taxes are assessed. It's the next year. So you got to wait a year.
So you have a cash flow
and
issue.
Have to, yes. And you really have to have a tax liability to write it off. Okay.
That's true. I'm going down my list here. Senator Boquist, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Paul, for the information. As you noted, the state revenue impact is $344 million. And of course, then you have the $61 million. That's sort of the impact on the individuals. But as you pointed out here, it creates 7,500 jobs. Of the 7,500 jobs, how many of them are public sector jobs?
The public sector, Mr. Vice Chair, I didn't print out that detail. I'll have to look at that. We have, we're looking at some larger impacts, and that's what I've got in my mind right now. So this is less than that, but I'll get you that. We have a table that shows each industry sector and how it's affected. You do see, of course, what we've done, just as a simplifying assumption, we assume that these dollars go 50, we only have an education and non-education components, so we assume it's split half and half, and so the job impacts are half and half education, non-education. But I'm thinking it's around 5,000 or so, but I'll have to take a look and see what that is to make sure.
Could we just make sure in the next meeting we have that table?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair. Well, I'll put that out on a list right away.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Chair, just, you know, my point is that we're talking not in isolation, though we're in isolation here, is we're talking PERS reform to my far left down there. Now, if you just added 5,000 new employees, we got to figure out how to pay for that. And then we're talking cost containment. And then this question is, if we're containing costs and we're going to hire people, then this model says we're going to hire 5,000 people. And then, of course, there's the deal of bending the cost curve, and you're not going to bend the cost curve by growing the budget by 5,000 more people. And so I think those numbers and what that forecast in this model is very important to the decision-making matrix of all the individuals here. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Representative Buehler, please.
Thanks, Chair Barnhart. Paul, thanks for the work. This is very, very helpful. In looking at this model, you know, certainly you've modeled it for adequacy, and my conclusion is here. We have a taking of wealth from households and we transfer it to the government sector. But have you modeled this also for stability, which, you know, I think in terms of what we heard from the Treasurer earlier today and from what we discussed at our last meeting, that's a big concern with regards to our revenue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Buehler, a couple of things. And the adequacy issue, you know, the assumption that we always make in working with you, you know, on overall kind of high-level fiscal policy decisions, there is no ideal or optimal level of the public sector. I mean, that really is a public choice. It's a choice that the citizens make, and they make through you and your decision. So there isn't, you know, one size government better than the other. So what we try to do is find, okay, you make that decision based on your interpretation of what the public demands are, and then try to find, you know, the implications of the revenue means of how you're going to raise those dollars. So that's kind of our approach on that. On the stability issue, this does not address stability. This is a comparative static model where I call it really a capacity model, where we're saying, here's what Oregon's capacity is now under the current tax system. Here's how it will change in the long run if we make this tax change. So the stability issue, I think, is really best looked at the stuff we talked about on Tuesday, where we compared the B&O tax with the corporate income tax. And we can show you that again in a more general sense. It monitors stability with the portfolio mix. But anytime you're mixing this consumption type tax like the CAT and getting rid of the corporate income tax, you're going to reduce your volatility significantly. Mm-hmm. Because as we saw in terms of the B&O's history and any commercial activity type tax, it's definitely more stable than the corporate income tax, and also over the course of the business cycle, more stable than the personal income tax.
Senator Hatz?
I just want to correct something that I think Representative Buehler said, that transferring this from households, I don't think we could do, I mean, that's the whole point of the income tax cut, and this is a tax paid by businesses. So I don't know if you misspoke or you're not reading this right, but it's not households other than the very high end, which we could correct, but that's certainly not the intent, nor is, I think, it doing it this way.
Thank you. Representative Fernandez, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have a question. So this model is assuming an economy without the $1.8 billion in budget cuts. I serve on a school board. We're going to cut with the projected at law budget 89 educators, 19 school days, cut programs, and increase class sizes. There's consequences to graduation rates. You know, we can create a model and simulation of what kind of graduation rates we can get off of that and how that can impact the economy. Anyway, my point is the results in which we see now is not assuming these cuts and the economic consequence of these cuts. Is there a way that we could showcase the better consequences if we were not to, if we were to act and change the model, if that makes sense?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hernandez, yes, and I think what you're getting at is I mean, we don't, in terms of looking at current service reductions, we're taking a point in time and seeing, you know, where we would be if we made these changes in the tax system. But I think where you're going with the education is, and making reductions in education or making increases, you're really talking about an impact on long-term growth and the long-term capacity of the economy. So we do have some, you know, we have typically just looked at this as a five-year period, and we've kept the spending side neutral. We assume there are people employed to spend money and so forth. But in terms of those impacts on productivity, so if you have a better educated labor force, for example, it's a more productive labor force. A more productive labor force is producing more per hour. Mm-hmm. So that will enhance the capacity of the economy over time. It also probably will enhance in-migration, too, as people come in for better schools. So those kinds of factors are not built into this simulation. We do have parameters in the model that link productivity in the economy to public sector expenditures. So we'll look at that for you, and we've started to think about that. It's one of the things we wanted to try to prepare for you next week. The problem we've always had with it is, one thing, the timing is so variable. So if you're to invest in early childhood education, well, when does that affect the economy? 15, 20 years, I mean, and then it's also hard to quantify. But we'll give you some scenarios that'll at least allow you to kind of think through that more. There'll be kind of gross estimates, but it's certainly clear in economic theory that a more educated labor force is going to be more productive and should have overall higher per capita income. There's a very strong correlation between income and education level.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes, please.
Because the economic models that we see here are not taking into account whatever budgetary decisions we make this session. On the one hand, on the other hand, I wanted to find out how, because this came up earlier, how public sector jobs impact the economy, and what kind of impact do they have on the economy, whether it be return in dollars for the state, more jobs, more investment, and or vice versa.
The public sector, the state and local sector is what we call endogenous. So they're affected by the size of the economy and by the tax rates. So when we put in a revenue package that increases resources going to the public sector, then we'll get an increase in public employment. We get an increase in public sector demand. So, you know, as I was saying earlier, you have this shift from the private sector to the public sector as a result of the revenue package. So that the model captures, we think, pretty well the demand side of that. If you hire a public employee, they're gonna spend money at the store and buy cars and all the things that anybody in the private sector would do, and so that circulation is not affected much. At a very general level, the wage rate for the public sector, because and this the skill and education level in general, is higher than the general private sector. So you do tend to have an increase in average wages if you make a shift from private to public sector. So those things are built into the model. But the piece I spoke about earlier, public sector investments and making education and improving the infrastructure or improving the quality of the labor force, those things are not built in, and those are the things that have to be augmented to the model to get you, in my view, something beyond a five-year look at how things would go, because you're looking at longer-term investments. But as I say, we'll take a look at that and get some simulations back to you where you can at least start to think about it. But it is an area where it's very complex, and there's just a lot of different things the public sector could spend money on that has, you know, different effects in the economy.
Thank you. Representative Bentz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Paul, for the work. One of the issues that's come up in my discussions about this concept has been the impact on small business. Those that are not fortunate enough to be like, let's say, Amazon, that are vertically integrated and would benefit greatly from a competitive standpoint from a device such as the commercial activities tax. And so the model doesn't reflect that long-term impact on small business in favor of large, vertically integrated businesses. So the challenge is, how do we develop a model that shows the overall impact on a, you know, driving even more business? I hate to pick on Amazon because I really respect their corporate model. On the other hand, they're doing 50 or 60% of total online sales, which when you start looking at those monster businesses, you go, at the end of the day, that's not good for the nature of our system. So I would ask, how do we structure a model that incorporates such a obvious yet hard to measure consequence? And I looked at it carefully and saw there's some cost issues that people might pay more here, might pay more there. But this is a tough thing to model. So how do we get at that challenge that this commercial activities tax creates?
Mr. Vice Chair, you know, the market structure of individual markets obviously affects, you know, how those individual businesses and industries will respond. What the model does is, I mean, it basically divides the economy into two sectors, two markets, The first market is Oregon. The second market is the rest of the world. So it assumes that anybody selling into the rest of the world is a price taker. They have no impact at all on price. Now, you could argue maybe Intel has some, but in general, that's the case. Certainly, if you're an agricultural exporter, that's definitely the case. So that assumes that you're a price taker. So your ability to shift that tax onto non-residents is very low, and the model assumes zero. So if we impose a tax on those types of businesses, whether small or large, that's generally going to have either backward shifting back on the other factors of production or just flat out output effects where you have less output produced. In terms of the Oregon markets, the economy treats any sales in Oregon as being subject to the cap. So that would be, you could be a big producer outside the state, and as we've talked about with the corporate income tax, you may not even have nexus here for corporate income tax purposes, but if you're selling into Oregon, those Oregon sales are taxed. So in that sense, whether you're large or small, if you're selling in the Oregon markets, in the domestic market, you're affected by the tax. And so what the model shows is there's where you're most likely to get your impacts on consumer prices from those local producers and in the local markets themselves, because everything is taxed that's sold in Oregon. Now, the consequences of that higher price level and the impact on the different size firms is not something we capture very well in this model. So, but the big distinction we make is between domestic and export.
Follow up.
Yes, please.
And thank you for that answer. The model is built on the concept of taxes on gross receipts in excess of $1 million. And so many of the small businesses in Oregon dramatically exceed that. And their sales are not out of state. But that's not really so much the problem as that which they purchase in state, having suffered the pyramiding effect that this tax creates. And so the trick is finding the model that reflects that inequity that's created as a result of the device for sales in state. I understand generally the benefit of taxing people outside the state by virtue of having the tax paid by just all that. I get it. But I'm more worried about the consequences to the smaller business inside the state that that has to buy stuff that's made its way down through the various levels and has to pay this tax. And so how do we tease that out of a model of this nature?
Mr. Vice Chair, we can look at it from impacts by sector. For example, employment impacts by sector. We give you a sense of where that effect is. We also can do kind of a rough measure of pyramiding through, we have a consumer price, and you see the consumer price is my price level here, is in the box here is consumer prices. We also have a producer price level in the model that gives you an idea of the extent we've seen of pyramiding. So we can look at that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Going down my list here, Representative Marsh, please.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my question, I think, has been answered. It was in regard to the importance of being able to measure the outcomes, and you said you're going to bring us some additional modeling next week that will look at the results of investments that are enabled by a mechanism like this.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Marsh, we will bring you what we have. I mean, but it's something that is real hard to have a definitive answer on. But we can show you, what we can get from, again, this is a very high-level model, and no matter how complicated the equations are, the computer programming, it's still a gross simplification of how the real world works. But we'll bring some estimated impacts for you.
Thank you, Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. A couple thoughts and then a couple questions. One, I want to thank you and the good Senator Co-Chair for the way you're hosting this committee. It's awesome to be able to ask these type of questions and get the information we need. And Paul, thank you for all you do and your staff. You guys are awesome. as I look at the conversation before us, I'm thinking from my district's perspective, and so with the $1 million exemption, many of my small businesses in District 57, the Main Street businesses, as I see it, are not going to even meet that threshold, and as a consequence, will be exempt. And then as I look at my district, I start thinking about the food processors who are doing a tremendous amount of exporting of product. Mr. Co-Chairs, as we move forward, I'd like to be able to get a little more information on how this affects exporting, those businesses that are primarily exporting. And I'm thinking of the Port of Morrow, Port of Umatilla, Port of Arling, Port of the Dalles, who do a tremendous amount.
That's part of why we're considering special rules involving exporters.
Right, right. Yeah. And so I just want to be able to get my arms around that a little bit more. Paul, can we turn back a slide or two to the bar chart you had? Right there, the change in disposable household income. Would it be possible for your staff to get us, based upon a per capita or individual, what each could expect the change in their personal disposable household income being, rather than having it in millions? So for the household that's making more than $205,000, what can they expect that change to be, that increase in additional taxation? And at the same time, for the family making $34,000 to $48,000, what can they expect to gain from this? And I don't expect you have those numbers right now, but is that something you could provide us as we're talking to our constituents in district?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we have the mean income change in that last column, so that would be the mean household in that group.
I see over there.
Keep in mind, though, that it is, I think back to the question from Representative Bueller and Senator Haas about these are real after price effect changes. So these are not tax bills that these folks are going to have to pay.
Mm-hmm.
This is an estimate of how they would be affected by, predominantly by, the increase in the price level.
So for just one last follow-up. So for a family with an income above $205,000, they could expect a mean income change in their household of about $400.
Household purchasing power, yes.
So I want to be real clear and get that on the record. Yeah. So for a family of over $200,000, the change would just be about $400.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
One last observation.
And then for a family of $20,000, it would be $112,000. So it's about, so that's, you can see how it's distributed based on the impact across the income groups.
Thank you. One last observation.
Please.
It shocks me that a conversation this important to the state of Oregon, this hearing room's not full of business and industry and everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Shocks me. Yeah. Just an observation.
Yeah, interesting
it
thing.
It may be online.
Thank you. Senator Taylor, please.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. So the a couple of things is that one of the things I was really excited about when we came together for this joint committee is I'm hoping that we have a joint goal of creating of changing our tax structure so that it's more stable. And we have seen, and it's hard for me to think that any of us really could disagree that that we have an unstable system. That's been proven. I don't even really know that it's refutable. And what I really appreciate for those of us who are serving on the Transportation Committee, on the big one, is that we're trying to craft a transportation package that has a stable revenue source for it going forward. And there, at least I felt like there was some support as recent as last night, that we were, at least I hope that we were all thinking, boy, it's really important that whatever transportation package we come up with, that it has a stable funding source for the next 10, 20 years so that we can actually do the infrastructure projects that we need. And I would like to think that we could come to an agreement that what decisions that have been made in the past, Measure 5, Measure 50, et cetera, has contributed to an unstable system. And I think we're now suffering from that. And so I would like to think that we could agree that we need to change it in order to make it stable. Regarding the modeling, I'm not a modeler at all, but I've dealt with many models in the past, and maybe it would be helpful, if I may say, that next week we could kind of have a little, you know, 3-minute tutorial 101 of how modeling is used, how it's used in the way it's used in the private sector and the public sector, it's a lot of the same, it's the same basic academic exercise, but the assumptions vary and why, what the impact is of those assumptions, just so that everyone in the committee understands and you don't get put in the hot, not that anyone's putting you in the hot seat, but so that you can maybe give everyone a little one-on-one of what it really means when we talk about modeling so that we can have, everyone can engage in the conversation at the same level. Mm-hmm. And then I was wondering if you planned in the modeling to show what the long-term impact would be if we don't do anything. So showing where, you know, we've come this far and we see what the impact has been, and I didn't know if you had plans for that, but maybe that's something we could consider, that 5, 10, 15, 20 years, if we continue with the same revenue structure, what the impact would be. And I just wanted to throw that out as a possibility, because I think the whole reason why we're here is in this situation now is because of the instability, and we, I personally think that we need to have additional revenue. And if we don't do that, I think we can maybe see what the impacts would be. So that's what I have to say.
Thank you. Did you want to comment on that?
Yeah,
please.
Senator Taylor, Mr. Chair, you know, what we think is going to happen if we do nothing, that's the current law forecast. And we've got it, you know, we have what the forecast is from the state economist. You'll get updated on that on Tuesday. And then you saw LFO's projections on what the current service is. So you compare those two, basically, what we were doing earlier this week, and you can see the gaps that are out there. So they've also done, speaking of the state economists, they've also done some interesting work on the demographics and how that'll affect the revenue stream over time. Now, they kind of build that in subtly, but that's a very significant factor in terms of our long-term income tax collections, and some very basic things like the fact that Social Security income is excluded completely from the state personal income tax. So that's, you know, that percentage is going to grow. So that aging is going to have a very significant effect on our growth over time. And I do have, we have some material on modeling. I think a pretty good article in state tax notes that I think we've shared with the interim committees, but that talks about what all the states are doing in this kind of realm, this kind of modeling. And so we'll put all that out in OLIS, and then I'll put together some backup material on that.
Yeah, we learn new things every week, don't we? I'm down to second rounds here. Representative Nose?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, focusing on the mean change per household. So those dollar numbers, is that just the mean change for a year? So, like, I would be, if I'm in the less than 20,000, I'm out 112. Or if I'm in the band 34, 31 to 48, I'm out, I can't hardly read it from here, 100, 155 for the year.
This is an eye test.
Yeah, it sure is. 350
Mr.
is an
Chair,
eye test, too.
Knows, yes, again, but let me emphasize that these are, you know, these are the effects of having a slightly higher price level.
Okay.
So that's what's transferring through here. You can see that overall income, per capita income, as a result of this change, is down $62 or 0.1% as a result of this change.
So follow-up was, would those numbers be different under Measure 97?
Yes.
That's why, that's my point. So
okay.
Let me answer.
I'll stop there then.
Is that, yes, right? They'd be worse, right, under Measure 97?
Well, yes.
Depending on your perspective.
Measure 97 had a bigger effect on the price level and also, of course, bigger dollar.
Okay. So I guess I'll just, my comment would be to my colleagues, which is I think that given the budgets that we're looking at, I want to believe most Oregonians would be willing to take some hits to their income in order to have good schools and not whack 350,000 people off the Oregon Health Plan. It's not that much to pay for that.
Thank you. Senator Bershinger, please.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You know, Paul, through the years in revenue, I know I've always said in our committee that for every time the state takes an action concerning taxes, there's a reaction from the business community, and we know that. Sometimes it's kind of hard to figure it out, but I you know, I was looking at this scheme in my office over the last week, and I thought to myself, you know, if you had a company in Oregon that produced $10 million worth of widgets, and they also owned a entity, say, in some other place in the world, wherever, and they sold all of their widgets to that entity, and then that entity turned around and sold the widgets back to Oregon, they wouldn't have any tax liability under this scheme. Is that correct?
Senator, I believe they would, because CAT is based on the privilege of making sales in Oregon, and that should be regardless of where you're located. Whether you're located in India or Idaho, you should be subject to the activity tax if you make sales in Oregon.
The words that are a little bit confusing is should be.
They should be. And well, and of course we've, you know, I think one of the challenges, and we, you know, we've been talking at a conceptual level and kind of how this would work and under certain principles, but of course all this has to be administered, and that's where the Department of Revenue comes in as a huge part of this. And two, initially of course they would be looking at different nexus standards, so they'd have to develop means to identify who's selling into Oregon now that isn't currently filing a corporate income tax, for example. And that would take some time and some resources for them to do that well. But certainly we see other states do it. I mean, Washington's B&O is destination-based, and they've really emphasized that. The Ohio tax, as we talked about, is destination-based. So there are models out there that states that have done it, but obviously there'd be a learning curve for them.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Hernandez, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. In line with questions from Senator Taylor around stability, the volatility of our current corporate income tax, we can understand the consequence of that volatility from the past. With this new model, could we model it backwards and see the stability of it based on previous economies, so that we can compare and see the benefits of having a stable, a more stable tax system, and what that benefit could be for the economy. I'm not trying to give you more work, to be honest. But
yes, you are. But
but I think it might show us. that this having stability is good for the economy, particularly in times of recession.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hernandez, yeah, the stability issue, as I say, it's separate from this, but it's one we've put a lot of time and energy into. One of the things that I can do probably in an hour is to update. We have what I call a stabilometer, which looks at the portfolio, and it assumes that it takes national data from all states by type of tax, and so you can switch your proportions. So if you say, okay, what if we had a tax mix like Washington has versus what Oregon has, or versus what Alaska has, then you would see the result is you see what the standard deviation is, how it varies over the course of a period of time. It's a 12-month moving average. So I'll show you that, and you can see. And we actually did some estimates around Measure 97, which did add stability to the system, because you're substituting a gross receipts tax. You made the shift, eliminated almost the corporate income tax because everybody would be paying the minimum, and the gross receipts tax was clearly more stable. But I'll run that again for you and see with different combinations of a corporate activity level, and pulling out the corporate income tax in and of itself has a very significant effect on what that standard deviation is over time. So you'll be able to see that and quantify it. That's it's kind of a pure measure, because it doesn't account for the economy or anything like that. It purely accounts for your mix of revenue. And so that'll give you an idea of kind of the consequences of making those kind of portfolio changes.
Thank you. Representative Buehler, please.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. Paul, I'm still puzzled by your exchange with Senator Birdsugar. Enforcement. So how do you collect taxes from a company offshore with regards to this that sells into Oregon? Isn't the enforcement cost going to be high and complex, especially as more and more goods are sold over the internet?
Representative Buehler, Mr. Chair, yeah, I think there would be challenges, and as the economy gets more complex, yes, definitely. But I think also there are very significant challenges, and I would argue over time probably even more significant challenges around the current corporate income tax. And we've seen this in a whole issue around the tax haven policy and so forth, that you have a lot of income that is reported outside the U.S. And remains outside the U.S. So I think that there are going to be challenges, but I'm not sure that the challenges in the long run would be any more difficult than what we face now with the corporate income tax.
Thank you. Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, to build on Senator Boquist's question, I think you indicated the model had built into it the assumption that the state would employ 5,000 more workers. I don't remember if that's true or not. But
Mr. Vice Chair, I've got to look at that to make sure it's true. I just kind of, we look at that, and we looked at it for a number of scenarios, but I frankly didn't look at it for this one. So I have a detailed, I can just print out and send to the committee, what we would estimate the change to be. As I say, we have a crude assumption that it's spent half on education and half on non-education, so we just split the employment effects there between those two sectors. But yes, you will have, you're transferring resources to the public sector, so you're going to have more public sector employees, teachers, or whatever, the budgets are increased, and so there will be an increase in public sector employment.
And that brings me, thank you, to my question, which is, if we just diverted that money instead to PERS, pay down, what happens to our
Mr. Vice Chair, Mr. Chair, if it all goes to PERS, that would be a transfer. So it would be comparable to you making a transfer to any other group rather than hiring employees. So, of course, the PERS recipients would spend the money in the state, so you'd have those secondary effects through that spending. But it's a transfer rather than a direct expenditure by the state government. So, and then of course you would have overall different spending patterns. PERS recipients are obviously older, and a different kind of consumer bundles that they buy, a different mix of products and services. So that would affect the economy, but we're not at that level of detail.
Right. Well, of course, thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course, the PERS recipients are going to get the money regardless. So I'm not quite sure why that would increase anything.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's true too. Yes.
Yes.
It would just.
So that would be a current law assumption. Yes.
All right. That may be something you want to look into a little further.
Yeah. I agree with Representative.
Agencies.
Yeah, that works. You started the conversation up here.
Apparently.
Apparently. All right. Did you have a follow-up?
I don't.
Okay. Senator Boquist, please.
Well, actually, Representative Betts didn't open Pandora's box, Representative Hernandez did. So, Paul, when you come back, here's an ask, and I don't think you need an answer here, but committee members, you need to, you're looking at a model, and it says it's going to create 5,000 new public sector jobs. This is the same model that we're saying is going to fill the current service levels at Ways and Means. So if you start thinking about this, colleagues, and this is the importance of what jobs it creates and what is that impact that we have for Paul to bring back, and what is the impact, for example, on the farmer, the wheat farmer in Representative Smith's district, and my seed farmer on this side who are exporting their product going out. And we had part of that on Tuesday. And that really needs to be integrated when Paul comes back and Chris is working that, because the important point I'm driving at here is you're in theory trying to raise revenue. This, instead of being revenue neutral, which is stabilizing the system, the model we have here in theory raises revenue to pay for current service levels, but in fact the model is forecasting you're going to generate 5,000 or 3,000 or whatever the number he's going to come back, new jobs. Okay? And so you've got to start, you mean jobs. We've got to be very careful. And that's the point that Representative Benz was raising, is that it's hard for us as a committee here, but we do have Ways and Means people here that may be able to help us, is that, okay, what function would we use to increase revenue for current service levels without increasing 5,000 new public sector jobs, which Paul mentioned are higher paying jobs, and the other 2,500 will be lower paying private sector jobs. And of course, what we're doing to do that on that far right column is taking money away from poor people to do that. So the question is what policy we would implement that covers current service levels raised, that issue, without generating new jobs okay, to do something. Because other than that, you've got to remember, you've got current service level, and you're creating new jobs in the future. Now, what there is, the answer to that question, I guess for some of you who haven't been on revenue as long, is that there's an offset. For example, if you have current service levels and you're saying we're not going to fund current service levels and we're going to use X amount of teachers are going to be lost if we don't do something. When we do something and we create 5,000 new positions, part of those are that offset that you would not have lost. Right. That is the equilibrium that you're trying to find, frankly, in a revenue neutral policy versus one generating new revenue.
I may say something, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vice Chair, yeah, I think where you're aware of the, and Vice Chair Benson's question too about the PERS, we're really getting back to remembering that what this is telling us changes brought about by the new system compared to our current law forecast. So our current law forecast has built in what these increased costs are to the state, what the current service is. If you don't fill that gap, if you don't meet the current service, reduce the current service level, presumably there would be employment losses associated with that, or there would be not as much growth as you would expect under the current forecast. So those things really interact, and the more detail we have, it's harder to really decipher what the current law forecast is, because we don't forecast at that level of detail for a lot of things. But it's very important to keep that in mind, that this is not saying this is what's going to happen. It's saying this is what will happen. This is how the outlook will be changed as a result of this policy.
Okay. Senator Riley, please.
Thank you. And just to follow up on what Senator Boquist is talking about, part of those are, and I'm sure he was saying the same thing, a big portion of those 5,000 jobs aren't new hires. They're the ones we would have lost.
Yes, Senator, again, that's what the current forecast is if there's not additional revenue. So, yes.
Thank you. Representative Buehler, please.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. So, Paul, you probably haven't had time to model this with regards to what it does to the Gini coefficient in Oregon in terms of inequality, but if I might just back the envelope, it looks like it would increase inequality because you're taking from income from lower income households and you're going to be producing higher income jobs.
Representative Buehler, this looks at all of the factors that would influence the take-home real disposable income of each group. So it would factor in the higher wages. And so we can look at this. You can see that the mean income impact is bigger, negative impact is bigger for the higher group, but we can also convert that into percentages, which would get you at the toward the Gini coefficient.
So
we can look at that.
Do you think it would increase it?
Representative Buehler, I think it's pretty neutral based on this, but we can look at that and see precisely. I don't think it changes a lot because you can see the less than 20,000 group is the impact in dollar terms is about a fourth of what it is for the top group, but their income is about 10 times higher. So, mm-hmm. So there could be some slight shift, yeah.
You'd have to also look at the jobs that are created and what their income is.
Representative, yes, we do. This model is—it's a general equilibrium model. So we're capturing the wages and capital income. So this is the result. This is the change from all their sources of income that go to these. You know, to the extent that, for example, dividend interest income goes predominantly more to the higher income group. That stuff is captured in this.
Thank you, Representative Marsh, please. Yes.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question my colleague here just asked really brings us back, I think, again to that question of outcomes and how we spend the money that you've raised and that we intend to look at. My assumption would be that the kinds of investments that we largely make in government in terms of education and health care as two of our big expenditures are ones that really disproportionately probably benefit our lower income families and individuals. Is that the case?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marsh, you know, I can still remember back many decades ago, one of my grad school days, and one of the things that they taught us was we'd just spent a lot of time with tax incidents, but then at the end, the conclusion was, well, you really need to look at both sides of the budget, a balanced budget or full budget incidents. We don't do that much in our analysis because it is really complicated to do, but you're exactly right. I mean, your public sector, the public sector is taxes by definition. You're extracting resources out of the economy, but then you're putting them back in a different way mm-hmm. that benefits different income groups. So absolutely, that is a very important point, and how the dollars are spent is what ultimately affects the distribution of the benefits.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hass, please.
Thanks, Paul. Just a quick question on the chart. From the bottom, the two from the top, it looks like on the zero line, they're positive. On the 20,000,
right.
Mr. Co-Chair, there's a slight positive for the if you look on the numbers there, for the 31 to 48 and the 20 to 34 folks. They have very slight positives. And again, that's because they are disproportional beneficiaries of the lower rates. They're picking up the 4.5 and the 6.5. Proportionally, they're benefiting more from that than the lowest group, which doesn't have much taxable income, and the highest group, which has a smaller proportion of the benefits.
Then how come it's a negative
exactly.
in the chart above? Is that a
exactly.
mistake?
No, the negative the look at the middle column is the difference. The medium includes the effect on the number of households. So what happens here, for example, is if you look at the 34 to 48 group, they have a slight increase in their share, but they've also got additional households. So there's more households to divide up this $14 billion. That's why the mean goes down. So this mean is a result of the change in income and the change in households. So in this column, this table here, is just that middle column, the difference between overall income that group gets.
So, but if I look at the bottom section of that, I kind of conclude that, as you mentioned, less than 20,000 people in poverty, many of them don't even file taxes, and they're not affected by the rates, however they are. So there's not much you can do there other than the social service programs are out there.
Or a transferable credit, or a refundable credit.
Okay. But it's a net positive under this scenario for the next two brackets, 20,000 to 34,000 and 34,048, a very slight decrease from 54 to 68.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair. I mean, and some of these, you know, even the increases and decreases you see from the total amount of income for that group, you know, are a tenth or 0.2%. So very minor changes.
And I think that was the whole point of doing the income tax the cut there. And if I could follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please.
I just want to make sure the committee knows that this isn't the Haas plan or anything. This isn't the committee plan or the Senate D plan. We picked 0.48 because that's what Washington State's aggregate number is for their B&O tax. They have lower rates and they have higher rates, but their average aggregate is 0.48, and so that was the reason for the scenario. And I look forward to looking at different scenarios.
Yeah, I think we do look forward to different scenarios.
The one thing we noticed with tax reform packages that we've looked at over past years is with any major tax reform, there's 1,000 moving parts mm-hmm. all over the place, and it's really easy, and it's maybe even human nature to pick out one of those parts and say, aha, see?
Right.
And it's easy for people to make a case based on a small part of this. It's easy to sink a whole reform crusade because of that theory. So I guess I would just encourage all to keep your guard up mm-hmm. those criticisms of those tiny parts mm-hmm. that are fixable.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I wanted to close by asking a couple of questions that I think related to the values and limitations of the model. One of the questions that came up for me was to ask whether this model accounts for the financial benefits of things like having lower tuition rates at community colleges and universities if the budget
funds them better so that the tuition can go down. Your model doesn't actually cover any of that, does it?
Mr. Chair, we're not at that level of detail. We would assume those kinds of relative price changes, the long run result would be a more educated population, which indeed would affect labor productivity over time. But yeah, we're not at that level of detail in those kind of prices.
And the model isn't really intended to predict those longer term outcomes, are they?
The model's essentially a 5-year in
right.
nature, but we can try to look at some longer run with the parameters I've been talking about with the
right.
education where mm-hmm. public spending can affect productivity in the model, but
Thank
it doesn't
you.
In this.
I think that'd be really useful. I mean, my second question on the same general topic is, if you spend the money in a way that leads to a 10% increase in graduation rates from high school. That would, of course, long-term have an economic benefit, but the analysis you've given us today doesn't actually reach to that, does it?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. It doesn't. The resources, the additional resources that go to the public sector are spent, but they are spent in a way that's neutral with respect to productivity. So you would presume that definitely some portions of public spending will have a positive effect on productivity over time, education being one, infrastructure being another. Straight transfers, you know, for distributional purposes, probably not.
Okay.
So it depends on the mix, too.
So I'm going to get back to a minute to the question that came up from several different people, I think Senator Taylor and Representative Hernandez. I'm very aware, and I think several of us have been on school boards, are very aware of the damage done to schools by this this on and off budget problem that we've had over the last 20 plus years. My view is that if you can increase stability in school funding, you do away with a bunch of the damage that gets done with that, with laying off a teacher 1 year and hiring him or her back 2 years later. This model, again, doesn't reflect that advantage of a more stable system, does it?
Mr. Chair, no. This assumes that these changes are permanent. So you're looking at, you know, a long-term policy versus another long-term policy. So it doesn't look at that kind of instability. But I mean, if you look at education, for example, I mean, going back to the increases in productivity and growth we've seen in the country as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking of Robert Gordon's long book on productivity that he just put out last year, one of the really critical factors in growth in American productivity was the development of the public school system in the 19th century and early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have that in Europe. You had a lot more private schooling. America was the first country that really established that public schooling that was universally available, basically, almost. Of course, there were areas when it wasn't, but that had a huge impact on productivity.
Yes, thank you. I would simply, we're just about to close, but I'd simply note that the comment made by Senator Marsh, I think, is absolutely critical. Most of what we spend inures to the benefit of moderate and low-income families, whether it's health care, schools, or a variety of other public services. Part of the rest of what we spend inures to the benefit of the whole economy, transportation, a good court system, and a variety of other things of that sort. And so when we're considering these numbers, we have to recognize that these only cover a part of the reality, don't they?
Mr. Chair, these numbers give you some sense of some trade-offs, some general tendencies. You know, when you're looking at really detailed types of policies, particularly around different types of investments, no, these are very macro level numbers.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. Colleagues, we've accepted the invitation, the kind invitation of the Senate committee to meet with them for the purpose of receiving the revenue estimate next Tuesday morning at 8:30. The House committee does not get off the hook. We are meeting at 1:00 today, and with that, we are adjourned.